So I'd like to tell you about some work I've been doing recently with Ofer Aharoni, Eva Silverstein, and her student Michal Fabringer. So almost everything we know about perturbative string theory is based on static backgrounds. Usually these are of the form of Minkowski space cross some compact internal space such as a Calabi-Yau manifold or an orbifold. But this also includes all of the recent work on anti-de Sitter spacetimes and even black hole spacetimes outside the horizon. But one of the main reasons we want a quantum theory of gravity is to understand space-like singularities, such as the Big Bang in the early universe or the singularities inside the horizon of black holes. And to do this, a necessary prerequisite is to be able to understand string theory on time-dependent backgrounds. Now, it's surprisingly difficult to find appropriate time-dependent backgrounds for string theory. Intuitively, one has the idea that there should be a lot of such spacetimes. You know, essentially all the nonlinear scattering of gravitational waves produce time-dependent backgrounds for, for general relativity and string theory, but almost none of these are known explicitly. So what I'd like to do today is to describe a class of non-singular time-dependent backgrounds . These will be under great control in the sense that they'll be weakly coupled and weakly curved. And yet, they will have enough to show some of the qualitative new features which arise in time-dependent backgrounds. And these include having horizons, observer-dependent horizons, much like de Sitter spacetime, and they will, of course, have particle creation as time-dependent spacetimes are supposed to do. So these qualitatively new features, which we haven't seen or cannot study in static backgrounds, will be present in a controlled setting. Now, what are these backgrounds? In fact, they're not new. They're spacetimes that many of you have seen before. These spacetimes are sometimes called bubbles of nothing, which arise and have been previously studied in the context of the decay of the Kaluza-Klein vacuum or the decay of magnetic flux tubes. But whereas previous discussions have focused on these as instantons or some sort of end product of a non-perturbative decay, we'd like to sort of advertise that these are very good time-dependent backgrounds in their own right for addressing a lot of these features that we're trying to understand in string theory. So let me start. I'm going to go through several, but let me start by considering the simplest one, which is the spacetime you get starting with the Schwarzschild black hole. These bubbles of nothing always arise by analytic continuations of black holes. So let me start with the so-called Schwarzschild bubble. And we'll see that this has horizons just like the Sitter space, and yet a perfectly good solution. Well, so how do you get the solution? You start with a Schwarzschild metric. So in d dimensions, you have the black hole metric takes the standard form. And now let me write the metric on the sphere in the following way. Okay, so this is the d-dimensional Schwarzschild metric where this function of r is 1 minus some parameter r0 over r to the d minus 3. And now what we want to do is analytically continue in two of the coordinates. So you now set t equal to I times some spatial coordinate chi, and theta minus pi over 2, the deviation from pi over 2, you set equal to a new time coordinate, I tau. And the net result is a metric which people see down here? I guess that's all right. Ds squared is you get plus this function d chi squared, same thing on the r direction. But now this becomes r squared minus d tau squared plus cos squared tau d omega 3. Okay. It's still a vacuum solution, and now there's some explicit time dependence in it. When you do this analytic continuation, the coordinate r is now restricted to lie only in the region above r naught. And r equal to r naught becomes a smooth origin of this coordinate chi if you compactify chi on a circle. So chi is periodically identified. And the space-time can be pictured as follows. Let's look at a tau equals constant surface. So a tau equals constant surface looks a lot like a Euclidean space of, dimension d minus 2. So this is like r d minus 2 with a sphere cut out. So you have some sphere of radius r naught cut out of the center. But over each point, you have the circle parameterized by chi. And the circle has some constant radius at infinity, because f goes to 1 and chi is periodically identified. So you have some constant circle at infinity. But as you come in, the radius shrinks down, because f is, of course, going to 0. And so the circles get smaller. And above the bubble, or above this thing, you get a picture which looks like that. So r equals 0 is not a boundary to the space. It's just the minimum size sphere that the space has. And this minimum sphere is called the bubble. So r equal to r naught is the bubble. And you can easily see that when you move away from tau equal to 0, either to the future or to the past, the size of the bubble increases just from this Cosh factor in the metric. And in fact, the metric on the bubble is just a copy of de Sitter space. So remembering that r equals r naught was the horizon over the original black hole spacetime, you see that the horizon has turned into this de Sitter space, this expanding bubble. And so in this sense, the space-time embeds a copy of de Sitter space into a perfectly good asymptotically flat vacuum solution of Einstein's equation. Okay, well, one of the reasons people are interested in de Sitter space is because of the existence of horizons. So we should ask about horizons in this metric. And I claim there are some. So the usual way of seeing them is by drawing a Penrose diagram. So let's draw a Penrose diagram. The Penrose diagram is a little bit unusual. So first of all, we have this extra circle, this chi direction, which cannot really be conformally rescaled and give you a smooth scry. So we'll just ignore the chi direction or fix a point on chi. Normally, in Penrose diagrams, you take advantage of the spherical symmetry, and you let each point represent a whole sphere. And if we sort of fix a point on chi, and we fix a point on the sphere, and we just draw the r tau plane, you're not going to see any horizons. It's going to look very boring. In fact, the r tau plane looks exactly like flat space. But that's misleading. And what you should be doing is including at least one direction on the sphere to see what's really going on. And if you undo that, say include r, tau, and, well, let's call it phi, one of the directions on the sphere, you see that the space-time looks like this. So here's now a space-time with at least a piece of scry plus and scry minus. These null generators are in fact incomplete because the bubble goes all the way out to infinity. Yeah?
The tangent to that curved line is sort of at 45 degrees in the end.
It's not, well, yes, in a sense, of course, asymptotically, this is approaching a null plane. But in a Penrose diagram, any time-like curve is as good as any other in terms of you can rescale it. So this surface is time-like everywhere.
But it is approaching the speed of light.
It is in the physical space-time, it is certainly approaching the speed of light. And you can see that because it stays outside the light cone of the origin. Right. So in fact, this is identical, if you want, to the region, I'll say just like the region in Minkowski space, x mu, bigger than 1. So the region outside the sort of unit time-like hyperboloid gives you a space-time very similar to this. Okay, so another way to say this is that if you take sort of all of Minkowski space, which you can represent as a diamond, and you just cut it off, you know, in the future and past, you get a space-time which is causally the same as this. Okay, so what...
Yeah,
there's stuff in the middle that's different, but asymptotically it's the same as that. Well, if you stay on the bubble, we know from all the studies of De Sitter space that there are horizons, that observers at different angles on this bubble do not communicate. At late time, they are causally out of each other's light cones. Here, that's still true, of course. The metric on the bubble is an exact copy of De Sitter space, but it's not enough. You have to argue or show that there's no way you can communicate from one observer here to another observer, sending signals that even go off the bubble. But that's easy to show, and in fact, it's very plausible because any null curve which goes off the bubble is going to project onto a time-like curve in the bubble. Any motion in the other directions is just going to sort of stop you from getting across the sphere as quickly as you want. So, in fact, you can show that not only observers on the bubble, but the claim is that any two observers with different positions on the sphere, so different angles, this V minus 3 sphere, lose causal contact at late time. So, independent of where they are in radius, observers off here actually have trajectories which sort of have them bouncing off the bubble many times, but nevertheless, any observer at all, if they have different angular positions, they will lose causal contact. And all time-like geodesics have endpoints on this surface, which you can think of as sort of a smeared-out version of future and past time-like infinity. All time-like geodesics end on future time-like infinity and begin on past time-like infinity in that sense. Okay. So that's the causal structure. I should say, I've been emphasizing the similarities with De Sitter space. There is, of course, one big difference. You can ask about the area of the horizon in this space-time. Now, in De Sitter space, you define the horizon by looking at one of these future endless time-like geodesics, looking at the past of the geodesic, and looking at sort of the area of that the cross-section. And it's easy to see that here the area is going to be infinite. So the area of the horizons is infinite. Okay. So there's no concern here about possible finite number of states and things like that. What about stability? So classically, well, to check the classical stability, you want to perturb the solution and see if there's any exponentially growing solutions. We did this for, first of all, by looking at a scalar field. Yeah?
Can you tell us a little more about what the horizon looks like in the Penrose diagram? How it
intersects? Yeah. The way to picture this, the past of a time-like curve like this is really governed by just its endpoint. And you're basically looking at the past of a point of null infinity. And so in Minkowski space, in Minkowski space, a point of null infinity has a past which translates into a null plane.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's really going on here is that you have a null plane in one direction and a null plane in another direction. The horizon itself, I guess, would just be for one of these guys. So it would look like the null plane, right? It would be the boundary of this past set, at least asymptotically.
And how does this hyperboloid relative to that plane?
Well, the hyperboloid is going to come in. Well,
it's not really Minkowski space all the way in.
No. In fact, so this thing gets cut off. So let's suppose that sort of null infinity is here, and we have somebody coming up and hitting, we have some curve like this coming up, and this should be the actual time-like geodesic coming up and hitting him there. So in Minkowski space, his past would look like this null plane coming in. Now, of course, we don't have all of Minkowski space. We have this bubble cutting out some region, and the bubble is, in fact, accelerating out so that it's sort of tangent to this line, right? But the bubble's also what?
Yeah, that's why I'm confused. I mean, because it looks naively like the horizon sort of in the part of the space that isn't there anymore.
No. But you see that the bubble is of course spherically symmetric,
yeah.
And the plane isn't. Mm-hmm. And so this hyperboloid, if you will, is going to intersect the null plane, and it's
just cutting through the hyperboloid.
So it's a bit like cutting through the hyperboloid with the null plane in Minkowski space.
And looking what's left over.
Yeah.
What's left over on the plane?
Yeah, what's level?
It's basically taking the plane and then just cutting out the piece that intersects the hyperboloid. Cutting out the interior plane.
Right. Okay. I guess that's right. Classical stability. So to check this, we would like to perturb the metrics and study the linearized Einstein equation. We didn't try that in the general d-dimensional case. We did look at the linearized perturbations in four dimensions because that's very similar to the standard work that's been done in, you know, perturbing the Schwarzschild black hole. We also looked at the scalar field in any dimension. So a scalar field, let's just do this. Say massless. You can look at the mass term. It doesn't really change anything. In any dimension, can be expanded, and in fact, the way to test stability here is to take advantage of the symmetries. This metric has a symmetry, which is clearly sort of U1, the rotations around the chi direction, and the de Sitter symmetry from all of that stuff. And so it has a large de Sitter, you know, invariance group, which looks like that. And so the way to study stability here is to expand your field into, you can do the usual expansion, e to the ik, chi for modes around the compact direction. You can consider some function of r. And then the rest, say, which is a function of tau and all the angles of your sphere, should be expanded in modes on de Sitter space. So you consider de Sitter space modes, del squared psi is equal to m squared psi. And then what you do is you try to see when you can find solutions. You get some radial equation for this script phi, and you impose boundary conditions that it basically be regular on the bubble and go to zero at infinity. And you find that you cannot satisfy that equation if m squared is negative. So the equation for phi has no solutions for m squared less than 0. So that means that there are no sort of tachyonic modes, if you want, nothing which would propagate as a negative mass squared perturbation on the de Sitter space. And in fact, in higher dimensions, one can actually do slightly better. You can rule out some range of m squared close to 0. So the m squared has to actually be bigger than some bound. And there's a similar analysis you can do for the linearized metric perturbations. So in d equals 4, there's still no instabilities for, you know, metric perturbations. Okay, so that's part of the story, but there's another thing you could check or worry about. Since we're looking at these bubbles in higher dimensions, you might ask about a brain bubble or an extended bubble. In other words, a solution which looked like one of these bubbles cross flat space. So, you know, you could take a d minus p bubble cross Rp, or torus, or any Ricci flat space you want. This is also a solution, but this is now expected to be unstable. There is an analog of the Gregory-Laflamme instability that can come into the bubbles.
Would you expect these statements to actually correspond to the decay of higher dimensional spaces in the same way that this Witten instanton corresponded to the decay of the supply vacuum? I mean, are there, do you expect to see more likely?
Well,
relative to
this, the reason we check this is because I'm going to come in a minute to the quantum stability of the solution. And as you expect, the solution's unstable to quantum nucleating more bubbles. Okay. If we had changed our boundary conditions to have some flat directions here, you would actually not have an instability for nucleating more bubbles because there'd be an infinite volume factor here and the action would be infinite. Okay, so we were hoping that one could stabilize the bubbles by adding this factor and just, you know, considering these extended bubbles. That doesn't happen because there's a classical instability which sets in, which is directly analogous to the Gregory-Laflamme instability, which says that long extended black holes, or these black strings, are unstable. Let me say just a word about where this comes from. So the nature of this instability would be that you have some bubble. Say the size of the bubble, it looks just like the size of the initial bubble at tau equal to 0 is some sphere, which we called here radius R0, and it extends in the extra dimension. So this is some extra dimension x, and the bubble, the instability would cause the size of the bubble to wiggle like that. And the reason that we expect this, we haven't done the calculations to show that there are unstable modes like this, but both of these instabilities arise from the fact that the Euclidean black hole solution has a negative mode. And that negative mode, well, we'll come back to later, but the Euclidean, sort of the negative mode of the Euclidean Schwarzschild translates into a static perturbation with a given wavelength. I guess I could go into this in more detail if you want, but basically by adding some particular wavelength, e to the ikx, in this extra direction x, for k tuned appropriately, you get a static perturbation, and then you show that that's the dividing line between the stable modes, which have shorter wavelengths, and the unstable modes, which have longer wavelengths. Exactly the same thing should be true in the bubble. Since you have the same Euclidean starting point, you just do a different analytic continuation to get to the Lorentzian solution, and now you expect that there will again be a dividing line between stable and unstable modes. As in the Gregory-Laflamme sort of black string case, you can stabilize it by just compactifying your extra dimensions on a torus where the circle is small enough. And all you know, all you need, so it will be stable if the size of the torus is less than R0 in all directions. If it's less than R0, then this K is always bigger than 1 over that radius, and you don't have any of this instability. Well, you won't have as much. That's true. But of course, R0 could be very big, and so it would still be suppressed somewhat. But it wouldn't be infinite, that's for sure. Okay, so that's the classical story. Let me now comment on the quantum side. What about quantum corrections to this metric? And that's when we run into trouble. So quantum instability. There's, in fact, two sources of instability here. The first is that if you go far away, the first is just the perturbative instability. So for large R, the space-time looks like flat space. It looks like a Kaluza-Klein vacuum. It looks like flat space with one circle compactified, where this is now the chi direction. But ordinarily, you have a choice of what your boundary conditions are for fermions around that circle. You can require the fermions to be periodic or antiperiodic. Because of the geometry and the fact that this circle actually pinches off and bounds a disk, there's only one spin structure which you can put on the spacetime, and that corresponds to the fermions being antiperiodic. So that means that even in a supersymmetric theory, if you want to consider this as coming from superstring theory, there will be breaking of supersymmetry in this solution. And the one-loop sort of vacuum, the one-loop correction to the stress-energy tensor is non-zero. And that's just the Casimir energy, basically. So you get a one-loop Casimir energy. Dynamically, what that means is that the geometry will then respond to that energy density, and the circle will start to contract. So this is not a stable solution when you include the quantum corrections. In string theory, we know that there's another source of instability corresponding to winding strings. If the radius is bigger than the string scale, which you can easily arrange because R0 is a free parameter, there will not be any tachyons in the winding sector of string theory initially. But eventually, if this is shrinking down, you'll get tachyons from the string winding modes also. There is another sort of related problem, which is a non-perturbative instability, which is the creation of new bubbles. Far away from your original bubble, the spacetime just looks like this Kaluza-Klein vacuum, and there's some probability, no matter what R0 is, that you nucleate more bubbles. Okay. So that's why this particular background is not a good or appropriate background for string theory. But we can fix this up and, in fact, correct both of these problems by going to rotating bubbles, bubbles that you produce from rotating black holes. Now, I think Joe once told me that nothing interesting would come from studying rotating black holes. Right? Rotating black holes are much more complicated than Schwarzschild. And Joe was
being lazy.
Well, I'm going to try to convince you that.
Too many papers to read.
Yeah, so yeah, it is good to sort of divide. Okay, not that's not interesting. Well, I'm going to try to convince you otherwise, that there's actually something to be learned by considering. Sure.
At each fixed R, this is De Sitter space? Is that what you said?
Yeah. At each fixed R, it's De Sitter space.
I see. So this sort of evades no-go theorem because the chi R direction is non-compact. I mean, right? Normally, it's hard to get De Sitter space even from the string theory.
You know, I never quite understood. You know, people were trying to find De Sitter space in string theory and working very hard, and it's been hard. I never believed that it was impossible, and I don't know.
Well, I mean, there are no Gauss theorems. Just for the global field equations, there are no Gauss theorems.
Well, I mean, in this case, we evade it by...
it's not De Sitter.
It's not De Sitter space, but it has a copy of De Sitter space in it.
I mean, if you think of the De Sitter directions as being space-time and chi and r as being the transverse dimensions,
yes,
it's mathematically like the compactness,
yes,
of string theory,
but it's not compact.
But it's not compact.
That's right.
And for that reason, I think you couldn't do. There is no analogous solution with r and chi compact. I mean, I think that's a it's not string theory, but the Gibbons. I mean, right.
Okay.
Gibbons has various Nogo theorems for getting De Sitter solution, De Sitter compactifications of.
I don't remember them, so I'll have to go and check where exactly this. This obviously doesn't satisfy the assumptions because there's no problem. But it is true that chi and r are not compact.
The first example of a real solution that has De Sitter.
I think so.
But it's not De Sitter. I mean, you don't have a finite area horizon, and you're not confined to a particular plane. Even that would look like a De Sitter space.
It has a naturally defined De Sitter space, in that this is a minimal sphere, the certain sort of the evolution of a minimal sphere.
Right.
And furthermore,
but that's a different criteria from what all of these Nogo theorems.
Yeah. Observers are confined in the sense that if you start anywhere near the bubble, you are actually confined to stay close to the bubble all the time. Right. That's the behavior of geodesics. So there is, in some sense, a confining. But I agree, I don't know any way in which sort of gravity is effectively lower dimensional or something. You don't have a sort of Randall syndrome type effect here. Yeah.
But there is a simple example. For example, I know where these bubbles come from. For example, in the gauge gravity correspondent that I looked at in this in accelerating universe, so I will get all these bubbles by turning off all the fluxes. So if you turn off the fluxes due to the brain, this is the solution you will get. And you can stabilize the solution. So as you say, the solution is unstable. But if you turn on the fluxes back, then the solution will be stable again.
I'm not sure that's true, actually. If you turn off all the fluxes, I think you just get anti De Sitter space.
No, I know that I get this.
You
this,
do?
This, yes. So I turn off the flux. So if I take the solution that I started and I just turn off the D3 charge and D5 charge,
right,
and insist on kind of De Sitter slicing, then I will get solution later.
I see.
Which is natural because you're also solving Einstein equations, which doesn't have any source. Not
I see.
Isn't this more like Rinder space? I mean, this is a way of forcing observers to become Rinder observers.
Yes, it has similarities to Rinder space. It also has similarities to moving mirrors. In fact, I hope to have time to describe. We did a particle creation calculation, right? This is what you're supposed to do in time-dependent background. So we created particles, and you see that this space-time creates particles exactly like a uniformly accelerating mirror. Because it behaves like, a uniformly accelerating mirror. But whereas uniformly accelerating mirrors were ad hoc constructs where you're required to put in some force to accelerate the mirror, this is happening naturally and no extra stuff. Okay, but it does have this problem that it's quantum mechanically unstable. So how are we going to deal with that? So we're going to go to these rotating or so-called Kerr bubbles. Okay, so here I'm going to spare you the details of the solution. It's a little more complicated, and I don't want to write it down, but I can sort of describe the qualitative features, and they are different in the following sense. The Kerr metric, let's actually start in four dimensions, because that's the familiar Kerr metric, and already you see some interesting effects. So this is just ordinary four-dimensional Kerr solution. It depends on a rotation parameter, usually called A. And what you're going to do is take this metric and analytically continue in the same way we did for Schwarzschild. In other words, the time coordinate becomes imaginary, I times some spatial thing. Theta minus pi over 2 becomes a new time variable. But to keep the metric real, we have to analytically continue A as well. And so we'll let A be I beta. And to see what that does, it's enough to look at just one component of the Kerr metric. And so let me just tell you that the Kerr metric involves a term which looks like r squared plus a squared sine squared theta. No, actually, a squared cosine squared theta. D theta squared. plus other stuff. And so what happens when you do this analytic continuation is that you get a metric which we're now theta's time-like. So it's minus r squared, and this becomes plus beta squared sinh squared tau d tau squared. So what this means, so let's consider the case where beta is sort of small, just to sort of get an idea. It means that when this term is small compared to r, again, when you do this, the horizon becomes a bubble. So horizon becomes the bubble, and that means that r has a minimum value, which we'll just call r bubble for now. Okay. So r has some minimum size. Along the curves of constant r, sort of along r equals constant, you can ask what the proper time is. Well, the proper time will be tau, as it was before for the Schwarzschild bubbles, only for a while, as long as this term is small. And then when this term becomes big, the proper time becomes e to the tau. The proper time is tau for small tau, and then e to the tau for large tau. Well, what does that mean? The size of the bubble, the other terms, the sort of d phi square terms that I'm not writing down, still behaves like e to the tau or e to the 2 tau. G phi phi goes like e to the 2 tau as before. And so this means that the bubble stops accelerating. It expands exponentially for a while and then starts evolving linearly in proper time. So the bubble stops accelerating. Yeah. No. If observers on the sitter space measure, you know, the area, they see it growing exponentially in their proper time. So here's a situation where you have a space-time which looks almost identical to the Schwarzschild bubble for a while. When beta is small, you don't really tell the difference. And yet at late time, the bubble stops accelerating and starts growing linearly. And in fact, the whole metric, you know, just involves terms like this, because it all comes from, you know, analytically continuing terms like that. And so at late time, the whole space-time is expanding linearly in proper time. And that's what's called a Milne solution in the sort of lingo. So we have a situation where there is sort of a phase. So it looks like a Schwarzschild bubble for a while going into a Milne sort of universe. Sort of linear expansion. So what does that do to the causal structure? Well, if the bubble stops accelerating, it doesn't get out to null infinity, and so we have no horizons. And so the space-time, in fact, looks like this. If you want to draw a Penrose diagram, you have a region where the bubble is expanding, and then it stops expanding exponentially, and it starts expanding linearly. But when you conformally rescale, what it looks like on a Penrose diagram is that these things all sort of come back and hit time-like infinity. Something like this. So again, this is removed. There's nothing in the center of the space-time. But this is now a space with a complete scry. Scry is complete. And in fact, so here is a good time-dependent space-time for doing particle creation calculations and, you know, testing string theory and time-dependent backgrounds. Well, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. What about the stability, right? We have to sort of check all, why does this go away? The point here is that the identification, in order to make this bubble, R equal to RB, a smooth origin in the rotating case, you have to do a twisted identification. So here I want to claim that we have sort of quantum stability. And the reason is that the identification, when chi goes to chi plus some radius r, you also have to shift sort of a shift in this coordinate. I probably called it phi over there. So you go once around chi, and you also have to shift this phi coordinate. And what that means is that the circles are getting big. The proper sort of circumference of the circumference of these compact directions, circles grow asymptotically. So the space is, in some sense, decompactifying. Now, the perturbative corrections, OK, so what happens? You now compute something like a quantum correction to the stress energy tensor. But unlike the previous case, where it was just some constant energy density asymptotically, because these circles are growing linearly with r, this is now going to fall off. So the energy goes like 1 over r to some power, which is, you know, like d or something in the space-time dimension. So you expect that you can correct. I mean, this is some small quantity, which is going to 0 asymptotically. So you expect that you can perturbatively correct the metric just a little bit by a perturbation which goes to 0 asymptotically to include this sort of correction. So you can correct the metric without changing the asymptotic boundary conditions. Furthermore, the non-perturbative instability associated with nucleation of more bubbles also goes away because the boundary conditions are wrong. Far away, this looks like flat space. The bubbles have basically decompactified, and you don't nucleate. So there's no more bubble nucleation. Since it's basically Minkowski space asymptotically. So this does appear to be a fully consistent, quantum mechanically stable, time-dependent background for string theory. Yeah.
You're saying there's two solutions which are stable. Let's make
that. Two solutions that are stable. Which are the two solutions?
This one in flat space.
This one in flat space.
Without quantum mechanical tunneling, there must be.
Let's see. I mean, this is a situation where you have a circle which is sort of opening up asymptotically. So in some sense, it's not at any radius. It's not exactly flat space, right? You still have a compact direction. It's just that the size is growing linearly with the radius. In relativity, we wouldn't say that those are exactly the same boundary conditions asymptotically.
Wouldn't the tunneling rate go to zero because the space decompactifies? The space becomes very large, so the tunneling probability goes to zero. So you really have two different spaces.
Well, I mean, David is just wondering if we really have two asymptotically flat, stable solutions. Can we go from one to the other? I'm not sure. But it seems that the boundary conditions are not exactly the same, even though it's sort of locally. Now, in fact, I think it's not the same, because you still have some supersymmetry breaking here, in the sense that fermions which go around this loop have to come back to minus themselves. So even though the loop is getting bigger and bigger, I think the boundary conditions are in a sense separate, different. Okay, so here's a stable quantum mechanical background, but we've lost the horizons. So you might worry that that's, you know, not so interesting. But we can now go to higher dimensions and find something perhaps more interesting. So this was all in the case of the simplest four-dimensional Kerr. Indeed, more than four dimensions, you have the possibility of rotating your solution in various orthogonal planes. The rotation is associated with a plane, and if you have lots of orthogonal planes, so you have a rotation parameter parameter for every orthogonal plane. And you can look at the causal structure, the property of these solutions, and you discover something very interesting. If you are, say, in even, if D is even, and all the rotation parameters are non-zero, so you turn on every possible, all rotation parameters are non-zero, so fully rotating in some sense, the solution is qualitatively the same as this. So it's the same as 4D Kerr. The formula for the number of rotation parameters, well, you take, one of them is time, so you have to take time away. You have one of them corresponding to this compact circle, the chi. So it's basically d minus 2 over 2. What? Yeah. You get one for every plane, but you can't include time or the chi direction. And so, or yeah, those are independent rotation parameters. Okay. But you have a hybrid case, an intermediate case, where you leave some of the rotation parameters on and others off. Okay. So if some of these parameters are zero, then you discover the following surprising fact. Looking at just the dynamics of the bubble, you see that in the directions orthogonal to all the rotation planes, the bubble behaves just like a Schwarzschild bubble. It continues to expand exponentially and goes out and hits null infinity. So in the directions perpendicular to all the rotation planes, so the bubble looks just like Schwarzschild. And in other directions, in generic directions, it looks like Kerr. It's like Kerr. So what does this mean? It means that in most directions, the bubble slows down, it stops accelerating. But in a few directions, it continues to accelerate, as it continues to expand exponentially. So this bubble is becoming highly distorted. That's the first thing. So the bubble is highly distorted. And it's as if the bubble expands exponentially only, I didn't say one more thing. In the directions perpendicular to all these rotation planes, not only does the bubble look like Schwarzschild, this compact direction stays finite. In those directions, it doesn't open up. So it looks like Schwarzschild not only in that it expands exponentially, but the compact direction remains finite. So we have the picture where the bubble expands exponentially into regions where the compact direction remains finite, but slows down and stops accelerating in regions where the compact direction is opening up. So it's almost as if the bubble loses energy when it's trying to get into this region where where you're decompactifying. And only if you keep your sort of compact direction small can it continue to accelerate all the way out to infinity.
Is that stable?
What's that?
That's stable.
Well, it is stable. We have not been able to check metric perturbations of these higher dimensional Kerr bubbles, because even the question of whether the higher dimensional Kerr black holes are stable is not answered. Okay, so we don't know that.
It just seems like, when given that, you have to have exactly zero angular momentum.
No.
You don't.
No. Okay, that's a different notion of stability. Let me come back to that in a second.
It is a different notion of stability. Obviously that's a conserved quantity.
Right.
But just intuitively, I'm surprised that such small changes in the initial conditions would seem to give such completely different asymptotic behavior.
Yeah, but this is, at late time, so, small changes initially can make big changes at late time.
Yeah.
We know that. Let me just say a word about horizons, and then I'll come back to what I think you're asking about how special this is. So what about horizons in this sort of hybrid case? I want to claim there are still horizons, although for a smaller class of observers. So for observers in the plane, or in the space, I guess, which is orthogonal to all of these rotation, the rotation axis, rotation planes, there are horizons because, once again, this part of the bubble goes all the way out to scry plus, and so we get a situation like we had before. So these lose causal contact because they go out to different points on null infinity, future null infinity, and so they can't communicate with each other. There is a difference, though, between these horizons and the ones we saw for the Schwarzschild bubble. In this case, these two observers could still send signals to a third person who is in a different direction. Okay, so there are people inside here who have wisely stayed away from this sort of, you know, strange direction where everything's expanding exponentially. And both of these guys could send signals to a third person off the space. But this third person could not relay the signals back. Okay, these guys have gotten out to null infinity just too quickly. And even though they can send signals to a later time, these guys can't send it back to you before you've already sort of...
Difficult to become one of these observers for that horizon?
Okay, so now let me address that, because I think this is related. The question is how fine-tuned you have to be to get onto this sort of subspace. And so let me give you an argument which indicates it's not very fine-tuned at all. In fact, I want to claim that observers are actually attracted to this exponentially accelerating part of the bubble. To the accelerating part. Well, the argument goes as follows. Consider a family of time-like geodesics, which are sort of near this accelerating part of the bubble. So you consider a family of time-like geodesics, and they have some tangent vector, which we can call C. And you can always define the convergence of these geodesics by just looking at minus the divergence. And you can ask, how does this convergence change when you move along the geodesics? Well, that's well known to be governed by something called the Reichert-Hurry equation. And the Reichert-Hurry equation implies that the change of this convergence as you move along the geodesics satisfies an equation. I'm going to drop some irrelevant terms which are positive and we don't need. So it's bigger than or equal to sec squared over 3 plus the Ricci tensor. So if the Ricci tensor dotted into a time-like vector twice is positive, and that, of course, translates into some condition on the stress-energy tensor known as the strong energy condition. So if your space-time is such that this term is positive, the convergence always increases along this time-like geodesic congruence. And that's just a reflection of the attractive nature of gravity. Things want to attract. If you look at this in de Sitter space, in the Sitter space, time-like geodesics are expanding away from each other at a constant rate. So in fact, the Sitter has C negative and constant. Well, how's that consistent with this equation? It's consistent because this last term is negative. A positive cosmological constant does not satisfy the strong energy condition. And in fact, this term is just canceling this term. But we've now put de Sitter space into a vacuum solution. So this term is zero for us. And so our time-like geodesics have to satisfy that equation. The time-like geodesics which are sitting on this exponentially expanding part of the bubble think they're in de Sitter space. So they will still have C negative and constant. But the overall convergence has to be increasing. And that's only possible if the nearby geodesics in the other directions are attracted to this exponentially expanding part of the bubble. So this tells us, basically, that the nearby geodesics are going to be attracted to the bubble. So this, it looks like it's not just a very fine-tuned set of measure zero of the observers. It looks like some neighborhood near that will be attracted and have these sort of horizons. Well, so we've got the horizons. What about the quantum stability? Well, I claim that doesn't change because the extra compact direction opens up in almost all directions, right? It's only this sort of special sort of set of directions orthogonal to all the rotation planes where the direction stays small. So one will again find that the energy density will fall off since the whole volume of space asymptotically is getting very big, and you will get a stress tensor which is going to zero, and you should be able to have no perturbative quantum corrections. So there's no perturbative quantum corrections. Now you can ask about non-perturbative quantum corrections in the form of extra bubbles. Well, here, in most places, we'll be able to use the argument we had before. Space is opening up. It looks basically like flat space. There won't be any bubbles formed, except along the axis, along the direction where the compact direction stays small. So there's a possibility, and we haven't been able to rule this out, but we haven't really sort of studied it. So there's a possibility sort of a non-perturbative quantum instability instability associated with nucleating more bubbles of the same type in directions sort of far along the directions which are perpendicular to the rotation planes. Well, I'm just about out of time, so let me just quickly mention some of the other things we looked at in this context. So I already mentioned particle creation. So this was just an ordinary field theory in curved space-time. Yeah?
Why is it not clear that there are just going to be these bubbles?
Why is it not clear that there? Why shouldn't there be bubbles?
Why are you presenting this as a
wishy-washy statement?
Yeah.
Well, I clearly would prefer if there weren't. Okay, so I'm holding out hope here.
I
don't know. I mean, it's just that there is a slightly funny, you know, the boundary conditions are a little different because it's, you know, the compact direction stays small at one axis and sort of opens up when you go away. And I'm just trying to hedge my bets a little bit. It could well be that there are more bubbles nucleated. It's true.
I think you might have some argument that the actual Black divergence is supposed to be.
Well, no, it's well. We haven't looked at it. Is the answer? So I'm leaving it possible. There could well be an argument ruling it out, and I welcome anyone to come up with one. We have not thought about it enough to say one way or the other.
But the difference, so suppose I had rotating planes and some non-rotating ones.
Right.
And if I then take a non-rotating one and add epsilon of rotation to it,
yeah.
And at some late time, that's going to hit the brake and make the...
Right.
That's
and I should have said, you know, these spacetimes, as I said at the beginning, have been already studied in the literature. And in particular, these partly rotating ones were used, in fact, I'm one of the authors, on papers which said starting with these sort of rotating black holes with just one rotation parameter in higher dimensions, you can reduce them in such a way that it looks like you're, say, creating a monopole-antimonopole pair in a background magnetic field, or you're creating some spherical D-brain in some background flux tube. And those configurations always looked like they were expanding out exponentially, right, at the sort of rate that we always expected. And so, you know, I never dreamed that the bubble wasn't expanding exponentially in all directions. But when you go back now and check, you know, this D-brain sits on the bubble, and it's expanding precisely in the directions which are orthogonal to the rotation plane. So it's all consistent. And if you check the expansion in the other directions, it slows down and becomes linear. So the earlier work is all correct, but we just didn't think of sort of that the bubble would become spherical.
Don't you think that fine-tuning should translate into some kind of instability that different parts of the bubble can sort of gain opposite angular momentum than these previously non-angular momentum directions?
Well, angular momentum's conserved. You're
right,
not going to switch
but
it.
If you could locally trade.
I don't know.
Does the rotating thing have angular momentum or is it something else? I mean, is that how I'm supposed to think of it still working or do better than continuous?
It is angular momentum. Yeah, it is still, it's like a rotating bubble. Yeah. Oh. No, actually, I said that too quickly. I think that's actually not true. Because rotation in space-time comes about. That's actually a very good point. The rotation in space-time comes about because of cross-terms, time, space, cross-terms. Well, what happens is that this becomes a d-chi, d-phi cross-term. So, well, there's an a here. And so the angular momentum parameter gets analytically continued in the time. So this is real. So in fact, these bubbles, and then of course the time comes from a parameter theta here, which becomes a new time. And there was no cross terms with theta in the original metric governed by A. So I've been, OK, so I'm misrepresenting it by calling it a rotating bubble. It's twisted. The spatial directions are twisted.
Aren't phi and phi both angles?
Chi and phi are both angles now.
Are you allowed to have a term like that?
Yeah, if your metric is, yeah, I mean, what you have to require is that if there's an origin, the space is locally Rn near the origin. So this metric has an origin, but you've got to look at sort of the d chi squared and the d phi squared terms as well as the cross term and say, well, when this coefficient goes to zero, everyone has to sort of adjust itself. And that's what gives you the identification. You choose the identification, so that's true. And you find that in order to do that, you need to introduce these cross terms. So, okay, so I'm over time. So I'll just finish up by saying that the particle, we did a sort of standard quantum field theory and curved space-time calculation for the 4D Kerr bubble, which is the sort of simplest one, where we had this sort of funny picture of the space-time looking like a Schwarzschild bubble for a while and then this. And we did it in a sort of standard geometric optics approximation, which is sort of the thing that Hawking did when he first did his black hole calculation. You basically just trace geodesics from scry minus to scry plus, and you relate e to the I omega u, modes there, to e to the I omega prime v modes there, and you can calculate the Bogoliubov coefficients. And what you find is that for, small beta, as you might expect, the particle creation is dominated by this de Sitter phase. You get very little particle creation from this Milne universe, Milne phase in the future and past. And it looks exactly like this accelerating mirror. The particle creation is very soft at high energies. It goes to zero exponentially. The total number of particles should be finite. If you put in some infrared cutoff, the back reaction should be small. Everything is under control here. OK, I'll stop. Thank you. Okay. Well, I ran out of time, David. I could have. No. Actually, we can only say a few things about string theory, but let me say it since you've asked. I'm glad to say what I know. Okay. Well, this, of course, is all the warm-up for what we really want to do, which is to do string theory in these backgrounds. And
can you say again why this is an okay background for string theory?
It's a solution of the vacuum Einstein equation, which has curvature which is small everywhere. So in string theory, we have an equation, an exact equation, which starts off looking like Einstein's equation. And then there's alpha prime corrections, and higher powers of the curvature. So the idea is that this by itself is not. The dilaton is constant in the background. So you can take it, of course, to be small. Or you can take it to be, have small coupling. And so everything is it's weakly coupled. So what you can then do is sort of perturbatively correct the metric. And in fact, one argument which goes into that is the fact that the curvature corrections here will be localized near the bubble. They'll be largest near the bubble. Again, go to zero at large distances so that we can expect to be able to perturb the metric and not have any trouble. Okay, string theory. We want to do string theory on time-dependent backgrounds. We have not done very much. In a sense, this talk is sort of an advertisement for saying these are an interesting class of background people should be thinking about. What we do know is sort of one or two interesting facts. Most of the time, time-dependent spacetimes do not have a real analytic continuation to a Euclidean space. So trying to define string theory in a time-dependent background by first doing it on the Euclidean space and then analytic continuum is not a general procedure. It's not going to work for most spacetimes. But here it will, or might, because here we have a well-defined Euclidean analytic continuation. So it's natural to start by trying to define the string theory on this Euclidean black hole background, and then just analytically continuing. There is, however, a problem. And the problem is this negative mode. So one has to be careful with how one defines the string theory on this background. And to illustrate the puzzle, and so this comes up sort of right at the beginning, imagine this question that Mark was just asking. You know, how do you get the exact string solution starting from this? I gave an argument here which says you just look at the equation, the motion, the alpha prime corrections are small, you can perturbatively correct. That seems obviously right. From a world sheet standpoint, what you have to do is you have to look at a renormalization group equation for the metric. The world sheet approach says you look at the renormalization group equation for the space-time metric. The fact that there's a negative mode, a perturbation of this metric, which has a negative, you know, this linearized Einstein equation equals to some minus lambda squared, translates into a relevant perturbation on the world sheet. So there's some relevant operator. And a priori, you would expect that this relevant operator would get turned on in the renormalization group flow. And if that happens, you get pushed away from this starting point. So we believe that doesn't happen because of an argument like this. But already understanding why that doesn't happen from a world sheet standpoint would be interesting. So that's might be, you know, what you might call sort of a zeroth order question. Just to get these to be an exact solution, we have to understand this relevant operator associated with the negative mode and its role in the string theory. There's also the fact that the one loop amplitude will diverge because of this negative mode. Now that should be interpretable as some sort of, you know, decay probability that will give some imaginary part to some energies of certain subs. You can analytically continue the one loop amplitude and pick up an imaginary part. It may be possible to relate that to some amplitude to create particles in the bubble or something. So anyway, these are some more questions than answers, but this is sort of the direction that we're thinking about.
But you're imagining doing this in an alpha prime expansion.
Well, you mean testing something like this or I mean, to get, I think there should be a general argument. Maybe there's a symmetry which is not satisfied. I mean, which if there was a symmetry that one could show, you know, this is violated by this and sort of means it doesn't enter into, I mean, it just seems like a basic fact that this should not be, we should not be driven away from this background, and yet it has a negative mode. So we're, you know, it's sort of one of the things we have to understand.
Wait, how do you just interpret negative mode in field theory aside from string theory?
Well, David wrote one of the papers on this Gross-Perry-Yaffe thing. So in field theory, well, I guess they interpreted it in the context not, of course, for the bubbles, but just for hot flat space. So you think of this as, again, a sort of an instanton for nucleating a black hole, and this gives you some sort of decay of hot flat space into black holes.
But it's not exactly.
Not exactly. No, but this is a negative mode in the Euclidean solution, so it is an instant time.
But its interpretation has to do with the fact that a black hole in the thermal equilibrium is unstable to expand in the
game. Sorry, unstable to?
Expanding or decaying.
Well, black holes go low and get cooler and then grow warm. Really possibly.
It's
a thermodynamic. Yes.
Thermodynamic instability, yeah. That's the negative specific heat, which is it. Now, so in the bubble case, we don't have that, right? There's no negative specific heat in the bubbles. So We do have, well, this in the Schwarzschild case, there's the Klutze-Klein instability.
Yeah. There is a background which I, which comes from this, again, Maldacena type deformations, deformations of Maldacena duality, where you start with a time-dependent background for a string theory which doesn't have any negative modes. And that's when you try to construct confining gauge theory in an accelerating universe. The supergravity dual for confining gauge theory in an accelerating universe. Because of the mass gap in the gauge theory, there will be no negative modes on the supergravity side. And for example, if you take Maldacena Nunes construction, which is just NS5 brain wrapped on S2, then you can make a wall street construction for this model, and you can actually check how big the alpha prime corrections are there. So and the starting point is a nice, you know, time-dependent background of your type, except that in some sense the negative mode is regulated by fluxes.
Hmm.
So there is a way of checking all these things. And there is a background where there are no of this.
But there is a real analytic continuation to a Euclidean solution.
No, it's not.
Oh well, I mean, if you don't have the Euclidean continuation, then this point is moot. I mean, this is a problem only in the cases when you have a real Euclidean continuation, which you're trying to sort of use, and then you have to deal with the fact that there may be negative modes. If you don't have the real analytic continuation, then you're back to the sort of starting point, which is how do we do string perturbation theory in Lorentzian backgrounds, which we really don't know, because all of our, you know, moduli space and Riemann surface techniques require Euclidean metrics.
Actually, it's also hard to do analytical continuation in that case because of the fluxes. If you have fluxes,
right, then they become imaginary.
Continuation because of fluxes.
Right.
But in the limit, as you turn off all the fluxes.
But you could, why can't you do string perturbations?
Oh, well, I should have said that at the beginning. No, I think there's a serious problem there. If you're given just a general time-dependent metric, how do we do string? I mean, classical string theory is more or less straightforward. You just, you know, solve the equations. But you have to do string loop corrections. And now we have to, you know, all of our technology is based on Riemann surfaces. Riemann surfaces require Euclidean metrics. And you've got need for Euclidean, Riemannian metrics.
Well, there are technologies that aren't based, you know, most of the real calculations are done that way. But in principle, I don't know how to change any of the general Lorentzian time-dependent background, but in flat space, you can do things in Lorentzian fashion.
The flat space you can go to, yeah, well, that's Lycone gauge. You can't go to Lycone gauge.
Okay, but he never had to, that way of doing things.
Well, I think we have to go back to the starting point and really.
I don't know the description either.
I think one loop calculations, higher loop calculations, we know how to do in Lycone gauge or in.
For
flat space, we do.
No, but for general time-dependent string backgrounds, there should be a way to do it.
There should be a way, but I don't think.
Slow, but I don't think anybody's ever.
The problem here is, of course, you don't even have the free string.
Well, we have particle creation, which is something, again, you have to deal with.
So even, I mean, before I get to loops, I can.
Free string. Well, free strings we have in the sense that, you know, we have an asymptotically flat space-time, so way out here we could start with some, you know, free string, and it's just that it's not going to stay unexcited, you know, or a single string. We're going to.
You're saying this.
This sort of bubble is asymptotically flat.
But how do I actually set up this particle creation thing?
In string theory. Well, we're not sure. Actually, there is a comment, actually more than a comment, there's a whole subsection in this paper which I haven't mentioned, which deals with non-local string theory. You'll notice that two of my authors, co-authors here, are sort of developers of this non-local string theory stuff. And they will argue that there is a sort of close connection between particle creation phenomena and their non-local string theory. I didn't touch that because I don't really feel comfortable trying to explain it, but they believe that that's a natural sort of way of handling this in string theory.
But so you're saying in this paper there is
a
description for doing the calculation.
There's not a prescription. There is a discussion of how you would sort of see particle creation in string theory. And that discussion involves the use of this you end up with a non-local string theory sort of type Lagrangian.
Why?
You're forcing me to explain within this section. Okay. So basically, So basically, you start with some vacuum state in the past, and you end up with some state in the future, which is a squeeze state. It's of the form of some quadratic expression and creation operators acting on sort of the natural out vacuum. Okay. So that's particle creation. And now, in the string theory, vertex operators are supposed to describe asymptotic states. And here's some asymptotic state with a lot of particles. And so they will, or there's some actual calculation which leads to the idea that the string world sheet, in order to represent the effect of this sort of state with lots of particles in it, you have to add into the string Lagrangian some sort of integrated, sort of non-local world sheet sort of operator.
Yeah, for a coherent state where it's using a dagger, that's the old story that exponentiating the vertex operator gives you the classical background.
Right.
So here you're exponentiating something which is quadratic in the vertex operator.
More particles. And
yeah.
Okay. So there is some sort of, some feeling among some of the authors here that that's the right way of thinking about this in string theory.
But what do we know how to calculate? I mean, the Bogoyev coefficients, presumably, one gets just out of a wave equation.
Yeah. And this is an ordinary field theory.
It must be the same as in field theory. And in field theory, there's prescriptions for calculating loop corrections to that, though nobody ever really does it. In string theory, presumably if we really need to know the answer, we could figure it out, but I wouldn't know. It would take some setting up.
Well, you don't want to do the string theory calculation by thinking of the string as an infinite tower of modes and adding up all the contributions from the modes, because as you taught us, modular invariance and all of that cuts that down and gives you a finite answer when the field theory would diverge. So, we really have to think about how to do things like, the Riemann, integrals over the moduli space of Riemann surfaces in a way which, can be done in a Lorentzian context. I think we're not there yet.